From APR, American Public Radio.
Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston C.A. For four extraordinary days in April, South Africa held the rapt attention of the entire world. In its way, the first multiracial election in South Africa was no less momentous than the shattering collapse of communism a few years back. In an age of rampant ethnic violence, the world is in desperate need of peaceful models of political transformation. If that's what South Africa now represents, it will have gone from outcast to icon in one stunning and historic step. To consider the meaning of South Africa's recent election for its new government of national unity, I'm pleased to welcome Stephen Klingman to Dialogue. Stephen, welcome to Dialogue.
Thanks very much, George.
Stephen, I think that above all else, this was an emotional moment, and an emotional moment for just about everyone in South Africa and outside, captured in lots of very captivating vignettes. I mean, for me, seeing first-time voters in their 70s and 80s, seeing maids and matrons share the same voting line, and seeing a new flag unveiled at midnight over the South African embassy here in Washington. So I guess I'd be remiss if I didn't start by asking you, what kind of emotional moment was it for Stephen Klingman?
It was completely overwhelming, George. I think along with millions of others, I voted for the first time in my life. I turned 40 just a few days before and had never voted anywhere for anything. And somehow in a way felt grateful that even when I was in South Africa, I'd never really voted for a white government. And there I was at the South African Embassy in Washington lining up to do my thing. And the best moment for me was not when I placed my X, but the moment before, when I really relished that moment. And there was a real joy and a pleasure and an elation that came with it. And there was another side as well, which I think many people felt, not only myself, but a feeling, I think, of humility and also sadness for what had happened. Of what it had taken to get to this place, and the full extent of what it meant just to be there at that time.
That's very rich, Stephen. When I think in terms of what you've just told us, Stephen, and your very poignant recollection of the mood of your own voting and the mood at the embassy here in Washington, and then the wisdom of election officials in South Africa allowing a process to unfold as it, in the way that it had to, I'm reminded of this thought, and I'd love to get your sense of whether it's an accurate one or not. Someone, and I wish I could recall exactly, but a South African said that the importance of this first exercise is largely celebratory, and that's really good, is to commemorate something. That when you think in terms of a, quote, Western-style election with all the trappings and so forth, look for that 5 years down the road as the National Unity Government goes into its 1999 election. Is that your kind of feeling about it?
I think so. I think even then it won't be a standard Western election. There are basic complications, not least of which is that all the electronic methods and so on just won't be accessible or available in rural areas and that sort of thing. Some people have said one measure of success will be whether there is another election in 5 years'
right.
time. But I think, yes, that's the time to do it. This was a vote which, as much as it was for the future, was also in a way about the past.
Yes.
It was a kind of accounting for the past and making good on the past in some way.
In thinking about this, Stephen, this remarkable moment and what's yet before us, which will have its difficulties to be sure, but is nonetheless marvelous, I try to think of the things, the elements that went into this, and several occurred to me. Let me try them on you in sequence and see if they make sense. First of all, clearly is the question of leadership. Because at the top, both in the figure of Nelson Mandela and F.W. de Klerk, you have two remarkable statesmen, and I think their Nobel Prize speaks to that. Would you agree with me that the country benefited from some very realistic and extraordinarily talented leadership through this?
I think so. I think it wouldn't have happened without that. I think something happened between Nelson Mandela and F.W. de Klerk in round about 1990 or just before then, And theirs has been a tempestuous relationship in some respect, but I think it is a relationship, and I think deep down there is some respect that they have for one another. What we tend to miss from this distance is the extent to which that sort of leadership actually goes down to lower echelons.
That's interesting.
There's a younger generation in the ANC which is tremendously impressive, well-schooled politically, very savvy in terms of the intricacies and the psychology of negotiation. Mm-hmm. And I think that that has been true on the National Party side as well, the government side. And eventually there was a kind of formula that came out, which was that as long as people were still talking, there was hope for success, and that almost anything was better than to stop talking.
I am deeply reassured by what you've said, because it seems to me that de Klerk and Mandela, something of an odd couple in a sense, have worked out a political marriage in many ways. And it's reassuring to learn from you that there are ranks behind them of younger men and women who will have the same.
I think that's right. And by the same token, one should say that there are and will be difficulties.
Yes.
I think that, within the ANC, there are different groups and possibly even factions, and there are different generations, people with different agendas. But if the next transition, say, from Mandela's leadership to the next generation, if that goes smoothly, mm-hmm. then I think with each year that passes, things will get better. Yeah. There's always the possibility, South Africans have to be realistic about this, that things will fall apart.
Right.
But I think that the quality of leadership and the quality of political thinking, which goes back a long way, really, far back into backwards into the century, is extremely high.
This is an interesting point in itself, Stephen, because I was just about to mention that it seems to me that other factors which played into this were that you had a clear moral issue. I mean, and that apartheid was there for all to see, and all of its ugliness and ultimate indefensibility. And this too, and this is particularly perhaps about South Africans, the pragmatism of the people struck me, and I want to ask you if that's an accurate kind of sense of it. I mean, things happened in South Africa, even during this process, that would have torn apart almost any other society one can think of. Extraordinary levels of violence, and yet the thing held together at least this far.
That's right, and quite honestly, I have no way of explaining it. One tends to romanticize or sentimentalize or whatever, and I can do that as well as anybody else. But there really is an extraordinary patience and a tolerance and as you say, pragmatism that has just borne this thing forward.
Mm-hmm. In addition to these sort of emotional and psychological elements that were clearly fundamentally important, I think you've touched on this earlier, and I'd love to get your further views on it. The very notion of a unity government is a strong contributing factor to this. Now, what is it? What does it mean?
Well, let me just actually add to what you're saying. I think it is a very important thing. And there again, I think one sees the wisdom, especially of someone like Nelson Mandela, who says that even if some of the other parties don't cross the 5% threshold that would enable them automatically to get a position in the cabinet, he will extend the offer of positions to them. I think it does a number of things, really. One is it actually incarnates that sense of unity, of all being in it together. In a way, I think it spreads the load, and it may in a way spread the blame if things don't go 100% right after this. But that had to be the first gesture. And from what I understand, it really at second and third hand and even longer hand reports than that, that idea of a national government was in fact the breakthrough, which allowed the negotiations to go forward.
Let's turn, Stephen, to the numbers, the precise numbers, insofar as we know them, because I guess for some time there'll be some question about the exact numbers. But again, that, as you well pointed out, is a secondary importance. The main thing is that the ANC stands at roughly 63% of the vote, and the National Party at about 23%, and then several other parties with lesser percentages. What does that kind of result mean for the way that Nelson Mandela is going to structure the cabinet and make the kinds of agreements he needs to make?
I think in a way it's the ideal result. If the ANC had won 67% of the vote, in other words, two-thirds of the vote, they would have had the right to rewrite the interim constitution
alone.
That's been set up. They would have done so alone, that's right. And in a way, I think Mandela is quite relieved that he doesn't have that opportunity. And I think even if he had that opportunity, he said he wouldn't change the constitution much. This is enough of a landslide to create a mandate to do all the things that they need to do. And on the other hand, it's not a one-party system. No. And I think both of those things are extremely important for the nature of the transition and for what comes further down the road.
What does the 23% or thereabouts that F.W. de Klerk and the National Party captured represent? I mean, what population is that? Who are these?
It's a good question. I think in the main it has to be white voters. But there are people in the Western Cape, around Cape Town, who are of mixed race, people in South Africa who are called coloured, who, funnily enough, switched to the National Party in this election, whereas they'd previously been oppressed by apartheid themselves. And I think there are intriguing reasons for that. The coloured population has actually switched allegiances at different times down the century. But I think that was a vote mainly of fear. Mm. These are people who have had a tenuous hold in the Western Cape themselves, and also some privileges because they stood in an intermediate position between blacks and whites. And I think that they fear that their hold on things may be threatened by a black government. I don't think that they had reason to fear, but that at any rate is the psychology of it. So I really think those are the two segments of the population that voted for the National Party.
And this, of course, 23% is a considerable percentage in proportional representation.
It's a considerable percentage. I do want to say, you know, especially for listeners who may not be familiar with South Africa, that not all whites would have voted for the National Party and not all coloureds would have voted for the National Party, that there is a proportion of whites and coloureds and Indians and everybody else who would have voted for the ANC or for other parties as well.
Let's talk about another political party and an ethnic group, in fact, that was somewhat problematic during the election. I'm talking, of course, about the Zulu Nation, about Inkatha, and you can't separate either of those from the personality of Mangosuthu Gacha Buthelezi. Inkatha created a lot of difficulty, finally entered the last minute and still was a bit fractious. What's their likely... I'm asking you to do a crystal ball, but what do you think they'll do?
From the latest returns that I've seen, Inkatha is doing quite well in Natal. Now, there are some allegations that this is due to fraud and ballot stuffing and that sort of thing. And then that may be true or may not be true. No one can tell from here. I think whatever the result, the ANC would be quite wise just to let them keep whatever they appear to have won in this election. I think that Buthelezi was fearful before the election that he would be excluded from power, that the ANC would really take over. The best thing to do with him is to put him in the cabinet,
yes,
if he'll accept a position. And again, to incorporate Natal. Natal has been more or less, in terms of black politics and in the Inkatha strongholds, has been like a one-party state. Outside of there, of course, there have been these conflicts between Inkatha and the ANC. And a transition in which all of these parties will have to come together will be an interesting one. And maybe having Inkatha in charge may in the end be the best thing for that particular region. Quite honestly, I don't know. And it may well be that in that region, violence will break out again.
Yeah.
But I think the idea of having the ANC in charge nationally, Inkatha being very well represented in Natal, may be the best sort of balance one can hope for.
On the other end of the spectrum, racially and politically, stands the Afrikaner movement with varying degrees of conservatism all the way to absolute resistance. I was struck, first of all, and I'd love to get your reading of this phenomenon with, I guess it's General Constant Viljoen, and his participation in the process, and I think his party coming out somewhere a little bit above 3% or so. What's the effect of that? He chose to participate, but clearly from an Afrikaner sort of rigidly conservative point of view, but what's the effect of him having done that?
Well, I think it legitimizes the election, for one thing, among Afrikaners. That's very important. And it also divides that right wing in some way. Those who have stayed out are pretty much marginalized at the moment. Who knows, they may grow in strength again. But I was intrigued to see in the paper that Eugene Terblanche, who leads the neo-Nazi movement in South Africa, drew 200 supporters at a meeting the other day, whereas he's used to getting people in the thousands. I think they're pretty much demoralized. And as I say, having Viljoen's party in there does grant the whole setup some legitimacy and adds to the impulse and the momentum towards pragmatism. Actually, I think the Afrikaners, by and large, are pragmatic, and they will knuckle down. They've got nowhere else to go. They are. That's where they belong, and people have said for some time, the advantages of peace have to be apparent to people, and
yeah.
I think that may come to sway people's minds.
Yeah. Let's talk about that, the advantages of peace and the prospects for success. And here again, I try to do some thinking about the elements that make South Africa a very different case in the African and world context, and perhaps should bolster our optimism, which I think should be everyone's goal. First of all, let me try this, Stephen, this notion on you, that it struck me that South Africa is a regional superpower. I mean, if you look at the African continent, this is the country of enormous natural wealth and industrial sophistication, and that, to a great degree, has to contribute to its chances, not just because that's power, but because people will want to preserve, I would think, that kind of power.
Yes, it is. It's a regional superpower within Southern Africa, for sure, and I would say within Africa. It's got a highly developed economy in lots of ways. I think we need to balance what we've been saying with some other realities, however, and that is that while there has this been tremendously developed economy, unemployment is running at 40% and above in South Africa. There's a generation of children and people, say, in the 20 to 30 age group who, by and large, have given their lives in the struggle in schools, who barely went to school, whose school systems were completely broken down. These are people who will need some kind of education or training for jobs. There are issues of housing. So many thousands, hundreds of thousands of homes are needed right now in South Africa, people who live in squatter camps and resettlement camps and so on. And there are huge expectations that people have had. I think they've been patient, but surely, you know, if one has lived one's life like that, one wants to see some benefit immediately afterwards. These are things that need doing. One of the benefits of peace will be that the army doesn't need to be as powerful as it used to be. One can begin to downgrade all of those things. One doesn't multiply all these administrative mm-hmm. structures. Things get simplified. Aid begins to come in.
Yeah.
Those sorts of things will help provide the money, I think. But it's also worth saying that there are huge, huge difficulties.
Let's focus on them. And I think you're quite right to balance this picture with those kinds of factors. And you pointed out deficiencies in employment, education, etc., and rising expectations connected with them. Continuing in that vein, what about falling expectations in the sense of any panicky flight of people whose skills might be immediately necessary to success?
There was panic before the election. Mm-hmm. The image that came through was of little old white ladies in Johannesburg stockpiling, and it really did happen. You know, cans of tuna fish and dog food and who knows what, you know, and buying gas cookers and that sort of thing. And apparently the aeroplanes were fully booked up. You couldn't get a seat on aeroplanes, and people somehow managed to be on holiday overseas at the time of the election. And I think people are actually not so much shamefaced as just relieved. I think that, again, the mood that we've been speaking about has overcome a lot of that. I think that foreign investors will be encouraged by not only the fact of the election, but the mode in which it occurred.
So much more to talk to you about, Stephen. I want to turn us very speculative in both the continental and international arenas in just a moment. But let me say first that this is Dialogue. I'm George Liston CA, and my guest today is Stephen Klingman, who's writing a biography of Bram Fischer of South Africa. Currently a fellow of the Woodrow Wilson Center, Stephen Klingman is Associate Professor of English at the University of Massachusetts. He was educated at the University of Witwatersrand and at Oxford. As I said, Stephen, I would like to put South Africa now in the continental context first, and it seems to me the first order of business for Nelson Mandela is going to be consolidation, and I don't want to de-emphasize the importance of that. That's extremely complex and will take a lot of time, but he's going to, at some point, willy-nilly be compelled to take a wider stance in African affairs generally, and very speculatively, I'd love to get your views on what that's likely to be. Will it be a kind of an aggressive interest in the rest of the continent or not? And one of the things that struck my interest was, at one point he was asked by a reporter what models he was looking to for this, and he said, there are none. He said, we're going to be our own. What would that imply for the way South Africa under Mandela may look at the rest of the continent?
Well, that's a very intriguing question. I think that his eyes will, as you suggest, most of all be on the domestic scene. But surely he is going to be looking towards the rest of Africa. Can I just digress in a way to try and answer this question? In a strange way, it may have been in a kind of long-term interest that the South African transition came so late, because South Africa was able to see and look at what has worked and what hasn't worked in other places. And the ANC through the 50s and through the 60s, in various ways inclined to perhaps a more socialistic vision than, say, people in America are accustomed to. But of course, with the collapse of communism, with the World Bank in control of most things in the world right now, I think there's again a sense of realism, and there's not going to be any wholesale nationalization of banks and mines and land expropriation and that sort of thing in the short term. So perhaps South Africa's biggest effect in Africa will be to provide another model of a new kind of mixed economy, a new kind of mixed philosophy, a new kind of mixed politics, which may provide an alternative model. And if so, and if South Africa can act as a kind of regional magnet for the Southern African countries as a whole, and then can perhaps produce some sort of model for the rest of Africa, I think that would be, you know, the best case scenario.
Yeah.
Whether that will work out, I don't know.
Well, you know, one of the things that has clearly been a result of apartheid was that South Africa was marginalized internationally. So despite whatever economic strength and power the country had, it never did develop an international political voice. That clearly now is quite a possibility, and some one I'm sure they will act upon. And how do you think that will work? In what ways do you think South Africa will make itself a partner in world councils?
Well, I think first of all at the United Nations, something has to happen now with South African representation. South Africa was excluded for so long, or else marginalized, as you say, but now it can take a legitimate place, and it has a voice, and it has a certain kind of experience. And my, again, idealistic nature hopes that part of their effect at the United Nations will have to do with visions of what's possible in the world. And if one thinks of anything ranging from Bosnia and Serbia to Rwanda or wherever, that visions of how to get beyond the present, how to deal with these intractable situations through negotiation, and how to get through and beyond what looks like intractable ethnic antagonism. There is a model, and there is an experience, and perhaps some vision can be conveyed there.
The next generation is going to be crucial to all of this. And this is something that was implicit in the conversation you and I had about Bram Fischer, because it seemed to me that his life was oriented toward equipping future generations of South Africans to think more nobly about questions of race and common existence. Are you optimistic about that? I mean, the 21st century, the great metaphor is just a few years away. It's just tomorrow, practically.
I have to be optimistic. One reason is because of our experience this week. No one ever thought we'd get to this point. And there was a pessimism that prevailed, I think, for many people for a long time. We don't have the right to have that pessimism now. We've seen the impossible happen, so why shouldn't it carry on? I think that's the approach we have to take. I think that a lot depends on, the lines of communication that go down from one generation to the next, the lines of transmission of these ideas and of these policies. The ANC already has a long tradition that goes back to 1912. It was the first nationalist movement on the African continent, I believe. And so it has a real heritage. It's got things to pass on. Now, the key issue is, will it be able to pass them on? Will patience last? Will those lessons that were learned through really great hardship come down to the next generation? And I think that the key issue in that is really what happens in the next 5 years, say. If that can happen peacefully, if there is a transition actually from Mandela's leadership to a next generation, and if policies can be instituted through that generation which just build on what we've got now, then I think with each passing day almost the prospects get better.
Yeah. Let me try a thought on you that speaks to this, and in a way both of us I appreciate. The great novelist Nadine Gordimer, in one of her truly magnificent essays, said quite clearly that the success of a new South Africa would depend upon people being able to accept a grander notion of their own identity and a newer notion of it, and sort of become South African above anything else they might be, and then feel welcome in this new identity, in this new home.
That's right. And I think no one should underestimate how difficult that is to achieve. One can achieve it on the notional level or at the level of ideas and say, yes, I am a South African now. But to achieve it in terms of one's everyday outlook or dealing with other people. That's extremely difficult. Again, I think the models are there. Mandela is someone who's done it in his own life. People like Walter Sisulu, whom we haven't mentioned today, but again, a remarkable person. And Bram Fischer, whom you and I have discussed on an earlier occasion. These are people who are one of his greatest effects, I think, has been to provide models of how identity can be transformed, how one can, at a very deep level within oneself, say, I really do belong here, and we all belong here.
Stephen, to conclude this conversation that I think has been tremendously eye-opening for me, I'd like to, in a sense, turn the tables, because, as you know, throughout the decades of apartheid, America was extremely vocal in justifiable criticism of what was going on in South Africa. And now we have this remarkable moment. And South Africa was not, of course, the only nation to have racial troubles. We had, and we have them here today. So maybe it's time to turn the tables in this sense, to ask you, from this experience, what principles come to your mind in knowing your native society and the society you live in here, in terms of what we might, as a people here, gain from what we've witnessed?
That's right. It's an interesting thing to be a South African living in America, because you're quite right that South Africa is not the only racist country or country that has racial problems, and I've seen it in Europe as well. What I would say there is, and I would have to preface what I say by recognizing that America has its own dynamic, has its own history, and things here really are different in terms of the social makeup and all of that. But to me, what is really important that has come out of, say, the ANC and its position through the century is the idea that we really have to fight against separatism. Okay, in the interests of equality. And if we can assume that there's a reasonable amount of good faith, and some people might question that, but if we do assume that, then we really have to get beyond separatism. That is the model that South Africa provides. And what it means on the part of people who have been oppressors as well as those who have been oppressed is a certain degree of compromise, but a certain degree of enlargement as well, to say, look, I can fulfill my identity, but I can do it as part of a larger identity. And that's fairly abstract, and maybe we're talking on the philosophical level and not on political or economic levels, all of which have to be brought into this. But to me, it really is about separatism, because I'm a South African, and because I'm a white South African, and because I've been through all of that experience, I'm dead against separatism of any description, of any kind, of any shape. I understand why it happens, but we have to make alliances, we have to find one another, we have to get beyond the present, and the way to do that is to say people are important not only because of who they appear to be, but because of what they say and what they do. That should be our measure of who we make our friends and who we ally ourselves with, not who we appear to be on the surface, but what we're like underneath.
I'm going to, in closing, step out of the moderator's role and endorse the comments of my guest and thank him very much for sharing that wisdom with us. Thank you, Stephen Kleeman.
Thanks very much, George. It's been a wonderful week.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Stephen Kleeman, Associate Professor of English at the University of Massachusetts, who is currently writing a biography of Bram Fischer of South Africa. I am George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Assistant producer is Dennis Saunier, and our technical director is John Tyler. Dialogue is presented by APR, American Public Radio, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in association with Radio Smithsonian. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For a cassette copy of this program, or for more information, call the Radio Store at 1-800-747-7444. That's 1-800-747-7444.